Welcome back to the program. That was Tish Hinojosa, Something in the Rain. I think it speaks well of our next guest from Florida. We have Greg Asbed. Greg, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. Good morning to you, and thanks for coming on the show at such short notice.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah. Well, let's start by just asking, and I hope I get the pronunciation correct here, where is Immokalee, and what is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers?
You almost got it right. It's Immokalee. That's all right, though. Immokalee is in southwest Florida, and it's a place where during 9 months of the year here in the United States, the winter months of the year, if you have an American-grown tomato, that's where they come from. And the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is a community-based organization here in Immokalee of farm workers. And we've been organizing since about 1995. To improve wages and improve working conditions, gain the dignity and respect that people who do this country's farm work deserve.
Okay, and you say farm workers, but I'm imagining they're migrant farm workers.
Yeah, that's right. Our members are mainly from Mexico, from Guatemala, and from Haiti. And although there are some American-born workers still left in the fields, but the conditions in the fields are such that nobody who is born in this country really wants to work in those conditions. You know, you earn sub-poverty wages, no benefits whatsoever. It's some of the hardest, most dangerous work in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So people in this country, rightly so, have moved up, you know, out of those jobs.
Yeah.
And they're left to people who come from other countries.
And isn't it true that farm workers are exempt from most employment law, most labor laws?
Yeah. Back the major labor laws, you know, back in 1935 and the New Deal, they passed the National Labor Relations Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act. And the Fair Labor Standards Act, the one that created a minimum wage and overtime, and at first farm workers were exempt from the whole thing. In 1970, farm workers were brought into the minimum wage part of that, but farm workers are still exempt from overtime. So in the field, you can work for 60 hours in a week, which happens especially in citrus and tomatoes, and you get paid 60 hours at minimum wage at best.
Yeah.
You know?
Could you give us the audience some idea of what the workers' pay is and how they're compensated?
Yeah. The latest numbers from the Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor, on farm worker wages is $7,500 a year. And that's without any kind of benefits whatsoever. So no overtime pay for overtime work, no health insurance, no sick leave, no holiday leave. You know, you work on Christmas if you can down here.
So that figure is about less than half of what our national poverty rate is.
That's exactly right for a family of four, yeah. So that gives you an idea of what it's like, what you earn in the field. But there's another side to it, too, which is that most work in the field, especially picking work, is done by the piece. In tomatoes, it's done by a bucket. That's about 32 pounds of tomatoes when it's full. And the piece rate, what you get paid per bucket, has been essentially the same since 1978. And that's about 40 cents to 45 cents a bucket. So 40 or 45 cents for every 32, 33 pounds of tomatoes that you have to pick, haul, and throw up to this to the field truck and run back to your row and keep picking. And that means you have to pick about 2 tons of tomatoes a day to make $50.
Wow. Is that about the average for both, I'm assuming, male and female workers?
Well, you can't assume female anymore because the wages have been stagnant for so long that the population has become almost entirely young single males because people can't make a living. You know, older people have been priced out of the market by the low wages. A lot of women have been priced out of the market, especially in the picking jobs, because you can't make a living unless you're just absolutely hauling butt all day long.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's a typical day like for one of these workers?
It starts about 4 in the morning. You get up and get your lunch ready to go. And then you come out here, and in town here we have a central parking lot. It's a big parking lot that all the field buses go to in the morning to pick people up. And it's kind of like a day haul system where you don't have a job, you don't have a fixed job, you don't have a company you work for. You go out every day and try to get a job with a different, you know, with anybody you can get a job with. So you go out in the morning, about 5 in the morning, the buses start to get together, and you ask for a job for from any number of about 50 buses, and head out to the fields at about 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock, you have to sit and wait when you're picking, especially in tomatoes, for the tomatoes to dry, for the plants to dry from the morning dew. So you're out there until about 10 o'clock, sitting and waiting off the clock. And then about 10 o'clock, you start to pick in, 9:30, 10 o'clock, you start to pick. And you can pick until, say, 5 or 6. Now the hours change, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and then come back to town. And you get back to town 7:30, 8 o'clock. You get back to your trailer, which is what most people living around here is, single-wide trailers that go for about $1,000 a month in rent, if you can imagine that. And because of those high rents, you live with, 10 other guys in a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And you get back to your trailer, and you want to shower, but of course, 10 other guys want to shower too. So you've got your hot water runs out within, the first two guys. So if you're not lucky, you get back later than everybody else.
Yeah.
You take a cold shower, and then you try to line up to cook your food. And by the time you know it, it's 10 o'clock, and you got to get to bed so you can wake up the next day.
And try to do it all over again.
Do it all over again the next day.
Well, can you give us a brief sense of the history of your organization and what the CIW has done, and what are some of the victories that you've had along the way?
Yeah, we kind of burst onto the scene here in 1995 with the first general strike here in this town's history. When one of the companies tried to cut wages from $4.25 an hour, at the time was a minimum wage, plus 10 cents a bucket, to $3.85 an hour and 10 cents a bucket. And we had been sort of organizing and doing education and leadership development before then for about a year. And so when that was the last of a series of wage cuts, when that one hit, we were ready. And so there was a huge community-wide strike, about 3,000 people participated in it. And for 5 days, we just took over that central parking lot we were talking about,
mm-hmm.
and didn't allow people to go to work. And that was successful in the sense that we fought off the wage cut, and we got wages up for a little bit. But, after about 4 or 5 days, people started to go back to work because of how poor everybody here is in town.
Yeah.
So from there, we continued to organize, and we had several community-wide strikes here. After that, in 1997, 99, and in 98, six of our members did a hunger strike that lasted for a month, asking for the simple demand of having the growers come to the table and to talk with members of our organization about wages and working conditions in the fields. And that hunger strike became national news. It ended when former President Carter got involved and offered to help mediate any discussions that might evolve, and offered that to the growers as well, and the growers refused. Because down here, the mentality in the industry is that we will never sit down with workers. In fact, let me tell you one little story that has come out from all of this. We were told this by one of the growers, who actually is a kind of a friend of ours, and he said he was talking to another one at a meeting, and they said, "What do you think about those workers in Immokalee who are trying to organize?" And the other grower said, "Let me put it this way. A tractor never tells a farmer how to run a farm." Right? So that'll give you a sense of what we're up against.
Uh-huh.
And we've been doing that for a long time now. And we've raised wages to a certain degree. We had the first raises ever back in 97 and 98. We raised wages by about 13 to 25% in the piece rate. But it had been stagnant for so long that wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we still really haven't had, with the industry, the kind of dialogue or the kind of negotiations that we're aiming for. So what evolved most recently out of all of this stuff is that we decided, if the industry won't come to the table with everything we're doing to them, then we're going to have their clients bring them, mm-hmm. dragging and kicking, to the table. And that's why we started the Taco Bell boycott.
Yeah, and that was my next question. If you tell us a little bit about the current campaign with Taco Bell and why specifically Taco Bell.
Yeah. Taco Bell is one of the major buyers of tomatoes that are picked here in our town. That shows you how big the production is in this area. The companies that buy out of this area are companies that are multi-billion-dollar multinational companies that need tomatoes year-round, and that shows you just how much is produced out of here. Taco Bell buys from a company called 6L's, which is one of the major growers in our area that produces all the way. It has land and operations all the way up into Pennsylvania from Florida. And Taco Bell, basically there's two reasons why they, as a company, are essentially responsible for the conditions in this town here. First of all, because they are so big, they have the power to change these conditions. They can turn around to their suppliers and demand certain things of their suppliers, just like Nike can of their
mm-hmm.
suppliers.
Yeah.
By being that big and being that powerful as a consumer, you actually have a voice in terms of how your suppliers do business.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Second of all, the profit that Taco Bell derives from the tomatoes here, essentially, this town, through its poverty, is subsidizing Taco Bell's profits.
Mm-hmm.
Because through the cheap tomatoes that Taco Bell can buy, tomatoes kept cheap by sub-poverty wages here in town, Taco Bell gets that extra few cents per every chalupa it sells in terms of profit. But what it's doing, really, is kind of taking that from this town.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the conditions here, this is one of the poorest towns in the country. When you look at the conditions here, you can just see it's just that the life is being sucked out of this town by all the big corporations that buy these tomatoes at cheap prices based on sub-poverty wages.
Yeah, but when you talk of Taco Bell, we're just not talking one company here. Taco Bell is part of a larger group of fast food eateries, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. It's part of Tricon. Tricon is the largest restaurant system in the world, and it's made up of Taco Bell, KFC Chicken, and Pizza Hut, and they just bought Long John Silver's and A&W Restaurants.
So they have plenty of money.
They got money. Taco Bell has $5.2 billion in revenues every year, in sales every year, and Tricon in total has about $22-23 billion.
Yeah.
You know, and they're multinational. They're huge. The fast food industry, people, we need to all understand this more. There's a great book, by any chance, in case anybody gets a chance to read it, called Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser. It talks about how important the fast food industry has become in this country. It's the biggest, single biggest minimum wage payer in this country today.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's where most of the jobs come from, that the Republicans are always throwing out there, how many jobs are created, and they're talking about service sector jobs, which is basically minimum wage, burger flipping,
exactly,
type job. And how much would it actually cost to increase the price of, say, a chalupa to actually give these people a decent livelihood?
About a quarter of a penny. That's how much.
So they could raise their price from $1.99 to just making even $2, making it easier,
right,
for everybody, and actually pay these people a living wage.
If they raised it by a penny, you know, if they charged the consumers a penny more per chalupa or whatever buy, and sent that penny on to the farm workers who picked the tomatoes that go into that chalupa, they would more than double the picking piece rate here in town.
Mm-hmm. Greg, I want to make a brief mention to the audience out there that we're going to try to take a few calls here. So if you want to start calling the station at 713-526-5738, then we'll start stacking that up, and maybe you can answer some of the callers that we have.
Sure.
You just concluded the what do you call it, the Truth Tour, Taco Bell Truth Tour. You want to tell us a little bit about that, some of the highlights, and what you accomplished?
That was an incredible experience for everybody here. We the Taco Bell Truth Tour was a 15-city cross-country tour from Immokalee to Irvine, California, which is Taco Bell's global headquarters, are located in Irvine outside of L.A., and back to Florida. We stopped in places like Chicago, Atlanta, Chicago, Denver, San Francisco, L.A., Memphis, Oklahoma City. And what we did basically at each step of the way was meet with communities there. We were received by communities, given a place to stay, given everything we needed. And we were about 100 people coming from Immokalee in a caravan that grew all the way to Taco Bell's headquarters and ended up being about 2,000 people in the march to Taco Bell's headquarters on March 11th, we just kind of took the message of the fact that farm worker poverty subsidizes fast food profits across the country, and we had an incredibly strong response. We had, you know, public meetings and then protests at Taco Bell's in all the cities where we stopped along the way. We'd have 200, 300 people join us for these things until we got all the way to Taco Bell, and we had a huge national convergence down there in the biggest, what they call Orange County, said it was the biggest demonstration in the history of Orange County.
I would have liked to have seen the faces on some of those minimum wage workers when they're taking your order, and about 200 or 300 of y'all pulled up in front of their store.
You know, the workers at Taco Bell have been fantastic with this whole campaign, because we've done literally hundreds of protests so far on this thing, and we've had workers give us a tip jar in San Francisco. We've had managers hand out flyers to customers, our flyers.
Oh, that's cool.
Did you have any workers pull out their aprons and hats and join you?
No, people are a little bit reluctant to lose a job that fast, but people have talked to us, because one of the things about Taco Bell is that over the past couple of years they've had three major class action suits by their own workers in the restaurant,
mm-hmm.
For unpaid wages, making people work off the clock and that sort of thing. And we've talked to workers about those while we've been out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been people who have told us about their own experiences. And it's not limited to the three states that they had had those cases.
Do you have any other plans now for another campaign, or is this one wrapped up?
Well, no. This campaign is definitely going strong. And right now there are students. One of the big parts of this whole campaign is students across the country. College and high school students, because that's who Taco Bell targets for their market. And students have been incredibly supportive as well throughout this whole thing. And one thing about young people today is they're extremely networked, too, across the country. And there's groups like United Students Against Sweatshops and all these other groups that have national networks of communication where they can get the word out to people about what's going on. So the students have been really key, and they have put together a campaign called Boot the Bell, which is to get the Taco Bells that are on campuses off the campuses until mm-hmm. they deal with this situation. So that's one part of what's going on. And May 16th, we're going up to the shareholders meeting in Louisville, Kentucky, where Tricon has its annual shareholders meeting. And we're going to...
What was the date on that?
May 16th, this coming month. And we're going to be communicating in creative ways with the shareholders so they know what the company's up to in terms of you know, refusing to care about the people who put the food into their products.
Well, let me ask you this. People who won't be able to go to that protest, what can they do to show support of these workers? Is there a web page, or is there an email that they can email somebody at Taco Bell?
Yeah, our web page is www.ciw-online.org. And that's CIW, like Coalition of Immokalee Workers. There's a lot of information there on what you can do. We have postcards that already have Taco Bell's address on them that we're asking people to send to Taco Bell. And so what they do, people will, from the website, they'll write to us, because we have our email on there. They'll write to us, and then we'll send them in the mail, say 50 postcards, and they distribute them among friends and their church and their union, whatever it might be, and send them to Taco Bell. We're on 15,000 postcards already, so that's
fantastic.
Yeah, that's really good. So there's lots of things you can do if you go to the website. Again, it's www.ciw-online.org.
Okay, well, hopefully the listeners will just line up and load your server up with requests for those postcards. I certainly will this afternoon.
Well, thank you. And the other thing, the key thing is really, I mean, the first step is just to stop and think, you know, because one of the things about fast food is it doesn't even give you a chance to think, you know. You get in, it's all nice and cool, you go and you ask for your number three or whatever it is you like to order, and it comes all wrapped up and you wolf it down and you leave before you even think about where you've been or what you're doing. And one of the things we're asking people to do is just stop. And next time they're in a fast food place, look at what's in the food. And think about the ingredients. Think about the tomatoes. If you go to Taco Bell, please don't, but if you have to, if you go to Taco Bell and you buy something, everything has tomatoes in it. Look at those tomatoes and think of the history of how they got there from the field onto your Mexican pizza or your chalupa or whatever it is mm-hmm. that you're buying.
There's a lot of sweat and blood in that stuff.
That's absolutely correct.
Greg, one of the things that we talked about earlier is Attorney General John Ashcroft a new initiative to enlist local and state police in the enforcement of immigration law and its impact. Do you want to make any comments on that and how it's going to affect your group?
Yeah, no, I can't. I would. And I probably can't say it better than some of the law enforcement people in this country already have. In San Antonio, there's the sheriff and another police chief in the city of San Antonio. We're both saying that it's basically
racial
profiling.
Do you want to wrap it up, or do you want him to answer some of these phone calls?
Because
wrap it up?
Basically, they're saying anybody who's an immigrant,
okay,
the police can stop and ask if they have papers.
Okay.
And, you know, how do you determine who's an immigrant?
Just hit the next button.
Do you go by accent? Would that mean that Henry Kissinger is going to be stopped and asked for his papers, or all the other people who have worked in high places in government for all these years who have accents? You know, it's just it's an unworkable idea that the Attorney General is putting out there, and it falls on immigrants.
Uh-huh.
And it makes it that much harder for the police to do their job,
yeah,
because the job is to protect and serve. You know,
or should be.
Yeah, exactly. And in our community, for example, we're a community of all immigrants here in Immokalee. And the police have worked for years to try to build a bridge to the community so people would feel trust and be able to report crimes and be able to work with them on investigations. And now if this sort of thing passes, that trust will just be crumpled up and thrown away overnight.
Yeah, I get the sense that if you're brown, you're going down.
That's exactly right.
Well, listen, we've got about 5 or 10 more minutes, and we've got a few phone calls here. If you could stay with us and answer some calls.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Go ahead, caller.
Hello, is this, am I on the air?
Yes, you are. What's your name?
My name is Tom, and I wanted to compliment your guest here. You got to realize I'm a long-time Republican business owner and generally take a dim view of the stuff I hear on KPFT, but I have to say your present guest is articulate and makes a compelling case. And I wonder why Taco Bell management is so idiotic as to miss the sales opportunity here in just helping these people. Have you guys run that trap? I mean, can you? I guess they won't meet with you, but can you sit down and say, look at the publicity you can get out of this extra penny a chalupa or whatever? How about that idea?
That's a fantastic idea. And in fact, that's exactly what we've been trying to discuss with Taco Bell. We did have a meeting with them. And to Taco Bell's credit, we did have a meeting with them on March 11th,
Ron,
the day of
just,
the big
just hit the next button
there,
once, otherwise you'll have people
with a delegation of workers
just
from the organization. And that was exactly, for lack of a better word, what we pitched to them was, look, your target market is young people.
And how did they respond?
Yeah, well, their response was not negative. In fact, the meeting went a lot longer than it was supposed to, which shows you that they were listening and thinking about it. But since the meeting, there hasn't been any concrete communication or change in how they do business. So, you know, we're still in the same situation. But we know that day, the message you just gave got into their heads. You know, and the message is simple. Their market does care about the conditions that the people who put the food in the products they consume.
Well, sure, and they should care, too, as humans first and as managers second. But look at the millions and tens of millions they're spending on jingles and TV ads.
Hundreds of millions.
And look what you can do with a few million directed high profile toward these sorts of issues.
It'd be a great commercial too.
We even gave them the motto or the line to pitch, which is Taco Bell is not just fast but fair food.
There you go.
That'd be an excellent commercial.
Yeah. I'm telling you.
Well, Tom, we appreciate your call. We're gonna go to the next caller and keep listening to KPFT.
My pleasure.
Line one. Go ahead, caller.
Tim?
Yes, go ahead.
Bill Zimmerman, Labor Radio, Portland.
Hey, Bill, nice to hear you from Portland.
I'm listening online. You need to push that a little bit more.
Okay.
And I got to tell you, what a fantastic program. If you can get a Republican businessman to change his mind. You're doing
well, I don't think he's changed his mind yet, but he's listening.
You're doing something right. I'm definitely jealous. I want this guest on my program. I'm going to have to get the email address and all that. But I just wanted to call and let you know we've got people in Portland listening to your program. You're doing a fantastic job. Please keep it up.
Greg, you hear that?
I heard, but yeah, that's your program. Good job.
Yeah.
Okay. He's going to commit to coming on to Labor Radio in Portland, right?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'll get in touch with you, and we'll set that up.
Great.
Thank
Bill,
you very
thanks
much.
A lot. Tell everybody
bye.
In Portland hello.
All right, bye.
That web address again, www.ciw-online.org.
We're going to line three. Caller, go ahead.
Yes, hello. This is Rocky Rushing. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. I wanted to call and actually request a song by Drifter by the name of Annie.
Okay.
Is it? I don't have that CD. But
y'all don't have the CD, Drifter?
No, we don't.
Okay.
Are you listening to this program this morning, Voices at Work?
I'm sorry, I actually haven't been listening to it.
Okay. This is a program for working people and working issues. We're not, you know, predominantly a music show, but if you want to call back later on in the afternoon.
I apologize for the disruption.
I really enjoy
y'all's show, though. And if you get a chance, go ahead and listen to Drifter. It's fantastic music. They play at the Continental Club fairly often.
Oh, great, great.
Thanks so
much.
All right,
Rocky, thanks for calling. Next. Who do we have here? Line 5?
Okay, a little problem with the phones. Here we go.
Line 1. Let's try line 1.
Okay, line 1, you're on the air.
Steve.
Steve?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Steve.
Just making sure. Got a question. He was talking about $1,000 a month for rent. Is there anything that y'all have done in the area to try and improve the rent conditions about possibly getting your own housing?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, too. And we have. We've managed to get about $15 million of new housing money into the area. And they've started to break ground, and it just takes a long time. It takes years to go from getting the funding and to breaking ground, to building and occupancy. But, yeah, there because of everything we've been doing, there is some new efforts to build new housing. And that's in the end, that's one of the solutions, you know, is to increase the housing stock. Because the stuff here is just incredible. These are secondhand, single-wide trailers that rent for sometimes more than $1,000 a month, like $300 a week. And the only way that can work is because there are so many people who need to be in this one little area during the season down here that the number of people compared to the number of housing units is just so much greater that you have this overcrowding built in. And so you have 10 guys paying that rent, you know, $30 a week. The thing about it is, though, too, is in a way the best housing program here would be a fair wage, because one of the things that happens is everybody here has to be within walking distance of that parking lot in the morning because nobody has a car, because nobody can afford to buy a car.
Yeah,
even
a fair wage
car
would be fantastic, but they're getting y'all big time.
And it translates into overcrowding more than anything else, which means you sleep on the floor, you know, and you like we were talking about before, you never shower in warm water. You don't have any kind of air conditioning when it's hot. You know, it's a miserable existence. But key to that would be a little bit more freedom. If you had the extra income, you'd have a little bit more freedom to live outside of this walking distance of this parking lot. And that's the problem. We have about 10,000 people who come in during the season to live within walking distance of a parking lot.
And that brings up a point. That's the whole free market mentality is just gig people for every penny you can, and it's the people least able to pay that end up having to fork over that money.
Yeah.
And what we need is a fair market, not a free market.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Okay, well, I wish you all the best of luck.
Okay,
Thank you for calling.
We've got time for about one more caller. Okay. Greg, any final thoughts, suggestions, what our audience can do other than make contact with you?
Make contact with us would be good. Just, you know, again, think about what you're eating and think about who puts it on your plate.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's a campaign, whether it's our campaign or in Oregon, for example, Pekun is an organization that's doing some great work organizing there with farm workers too. Learn about the campaigns that are going on and support them, because the problem is, you know, out of everything that's out there in the world, there are very few places where workers are really organizing.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, you got to find it and support it where you can.
Yeah, because I, you know, it's long been known that, you know, in your own little town, when everything's going good, you got to remember that in another town somebody doesn't have it so good. So it's always important to support those workers wherever they may be. It's called solidarity, and that's the only way that we can make changes for the better.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Brother. Well, appreciate you coming on the program on short notice, and wish you well down there, and do keep in touch.
We will. Thank you all very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Okay, that was Greg Asbed. He's with the Coalition for Immokalee Workers in Immokalee, Florida. And very interesting stuff here that he's telling us about.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize some of the conditions people have to work under, even in this country.
Well, look, I'm going to sing you a couple of more. And then.
Yeah.
So what do we got coming up right now?
We're going to take a little break here, a little Utah Phillips, kind of change gears, and hopefully we'll make contact with a spokesperson from a lady in Dallas who's going to speak briefly about the National Committee for Pay Equity. There's a day of action next Tuesday.
I've gotten myself too busy this weekend, but I'll go off by myself sometimes and sleep under a tree. I'll be perfectly all right. Let's see. Yeah, the labor movement, free speech. Well, a strike is a massive act of free speech, isn't it? Free speech. I do understand the need for legislative action. I do understand the need for judicial action. But I also understand that it's absolutely essential that we have action on the shop floor, action in the workplace. Direct action. I'm not talking about them competing. I'm talking about them two hands of the same body working together. You understand? Rather than throwing rocks at each other like they do in the environmental movement. Shop job action, action on the shop floor. Well, it's always been that way in the labor movement, the struggle to build workplace democracy. These old immigrant people I sing about, you know, that never knew democracy, never knew freedom, where they came from. They came over to this country, and they saw that ballot box, and they saw those political parties. They embraced the tools of democracy, embraced them, fell in love with them. Took about a year to figure out that if you brought those same tools into the workplace, they called out the National Guard and gunned you down. Took about a year to figure out that the boss wasn't and isn't serious about democracy. So the workers got to be serious about democracy. But building democracy where you live and work, democracy between you and your workmates, you and your lover, you and your children. Building democracy where we live and work, because if we can't do it there, the biggest damn ballot box in the world won't do it for us. All right? So that's what the labor movement's stake in this is.
Break here, and that was Utah Phillips. We're back to the program, and our next guest is, if we could get her on the line, Ron, I believe it's line six.
Are you on the air?
Christine?
Chris is on, yes.
Chris.
Hello.
Hello, this is Tim Pagel in Houston.
Hello, good to be on.
Thank you very much. Once again, on short notice, you could tell us a little bit about this National Committee for Pay Equity.
Well, for several years now, the National Pay Equity Commission, along with coalitions of women's groups and other supportive groups, have been celebrating Equal Pay Day. Equal Pay Day will be on April 16th, this forthcoming Tuesday, and all around the nation, women and their families and people who support pay equity will be advancing the whole issue of pay equity. The whole issue of pay equity has to do with the fact that although we think we are advancing, women are still at a wage gap and are making only 73% of what a man makes, 73% of a dollar. Now, the important thing here is that the census data indicates that the year-round jobs average only 73% of women's salaries, and there's been a decline since 1997. At one point, women were making 74 cents for every dollar of men's earning. The reason this is even more serious for people of color, African and women, American women averaged only 65% of men's earnings, and Hispanic women averaged only 52 cents for every dollar.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So this has been a major decline. So around the nation, on Tuesday, you will see women doing several things. For example, in Austin, there will be a major Equal Pay Day rally and press conference. It will be in the Speaker's Committee Room at the State Capitol, and there will be people from all the organizations bringing attention to this issue. A spokesman for Congressman Lloyd Doggett, our congressman here in Texas, will address the rally, and there will be speakers from various organizations. In Dallas, we are having another major event, and it is called an Unhappy Hour. And the Unhappy Hour will feature the fact that we are unhappy with the fact that we cannot support our family, especially single heads of households. We are unhappy with the wage gap and happy about the shows, the recent study that shows that women managers are losing ground in closing the wage gap. And in general, we're unhappy with the fact that women cannot traditionally offer a living conditions for their families because of the wage gap.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just some of the things that we're doing in Austin. I called the Pay Equity Commission in Washington this morning to find out if there's anything that they know of happening in Houston directly, and they said that their understanding is the Houston women organizations are joining in the big rally in Austin.
Okay.
Beyond that, I think what's critical to know is that around the nation, we are working very hard to focus on a federal piece of legislation that is called the Paycheck Fairness Act. The Paycheck Fairness Act is Senate Act 77 and House Act 781. It's been co-sponsored on the Senate side by Senator Tom Daschle, and on the House side by Representative Rosa DeLauro, who's from Connecticut. It basically provides for tougher enforcement of the Equal Pay Act. It protects employees who discuss wages with coworkers from retaliation. It also directs the Department of Labor to develop volunteer guidelines, which will allow employers to compare job categories based on educational, working conditions, responsibilities, to see how they match up in regards to equal pay for equal work. And it also provides training to Equal Employment Opportunity Commission so that they can work with employees in regards to anything that has to do with wage discrimination.
Okay. One of the questions I have or comments is that what is the difference, if any, between the pay equities in, let's say, a union shop or somebody that has a union contract, a women's contract, versus the non-union workplace or work environment? Is there still that gap?
I don't, from my point of view, and I have to be very honest that I probably your other guests could better answer that question in regards to union and non-union. As a generality, union workers definitely have wages that are in sync with their work.
Uh-huh.
However, I think where the disparity comes there is that women in general are still very much underrepresented in union and trades.
Right.
I know that in the past and even now, various community colleges, state schools, trade schools are trying to encourage more women into the trades and into union-related occupations, because we know that there is a potential for better self-sufficiency and economic self-sufficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the fact that a union contract can state in there that there has to be equity among male and female employees, and it can be dealt with in an arbitration on a local level rather than having to rely on the federal government.
Exactly. And so that also allows, as you said, advocates for the workers, whether they be male or female, to have representation. I know for a fact that as we look at the wage disparities exist in the categories, as we just mentioned, fewer women in management, positions. And most women are in healthcare and in service-related industries that, as we know as a rule, are lower paying than jobs that are, as you mentioned, the trades or in management or in administration, which allows them not only the mobility, but the possibility for advancement and therefore higher wages,
mm-hmm,
and higher benefits.
Well, it's my observation that there's certainly plenty of women in the organized workforce in this country. I don't know what the statistics are, but if you look at the leadership roles in major unions in this country, that their positions are held very few by women, and I think that might be one of the problems, if you will, of why these issues aren't being addressed.
Well, the good thing is that there's a sense that some of that is starting to change. It needs to be accelerated, but I do believe that unions are starting to figure out that who our allies are, and
right.
And helping women get equal pay, it benefits everybody, because anytime, it doesn't matter what group it is being taken advantage of, it brings all of us down. And
right.
I think we're finally starting to realize that.
Well, and beyond that, we're not just talking the fact that, it's a spiral issue, because if women are making less wages than men to begin with, we are then moving into how that is reflected in their Social Security, and we know Social Security right now is a very hot issue as far as the solvency of Social Security. But we also know that because women, their earnings are less to begin with, definitely their benefits through Social Security and any type of retirement package will be lessened, you know, in the future. So that is why there has always been in the background what they call the feminization of poverty, where women in general, even if they are retirement age or have been phased out of the system, are living at a poverty level in greater numbers than men are. So it is not just the issue of the women who are working at this point. It has to deal with our mothers, our grandmothers, our aunts, who have been in the workforce in the past and now are living, you know, on basic retirement packages and or Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
So the equity issue, I do agree with you that we are making some headway. I know that usually through the Department of Labor, the Women's Bureau Department of Labor, there have been opportunities to do proposals through the trade schools, which again, as I shared with you, allow women to advance into the trade occupations or the high-tech occupations, where women are definitely moving into an area of expertise which brings with it better salaries.
Yeah, one thing I'd just like to mention, locally here in Houston, I was told that the Coalition of Labor Union Women, CLU, is asking people on the 16th to wear a dollar pinned
right.
to your shirt and to take a yellow dot, put it on the face of the president, and write 73 cents to illustrate that women are only getting 73 cents on the dollar.
Yes, I have to give a plug there to Business and Professional Women USA, which is the organization that I represent. That initiative started with us wearing the dollar as a ribbon. And beyond that, you will see other things happening on Tuesday. You will see the ribbon, dollar ribbon. You will see some women throughout Texas who are business and professional BPW women wearing a red purse pin attached to that ribbon, which indicates that we're still in the red. You will see women who are wearing beyond that pin, sometimes carrying a red purse. We also have red bumper stickers that will be very visible. We are encouraging, and you will see letters to the editor, and as I said, the event in Dallas, which is the unhappy hour, we have invited our local officials to attend, anywhere from our municipal to our federal officials to attend, not only the ones who are sponsoring, as I said, the Paycheck Fairness Act, but persons who have more interest and want to know more about it. And the other thing that you will see happening all around the states nationally is proclamations from mayors. So I would anticipate that the mayor of Houston would be sending out a proclamation acknowledging Pay Equal Pay Day. Here in Dallas, of course, our newly elected Laura Miller will be presenting a proclamation on behalf of the city to the Business and Professional Women and the Coalition of Women here. And their supporters.
Okay.
So it's not only the dollar pin, and I'm glad you mentioned that, Tim, because we are encouraging anyone who has a mother who has worked. You know, all of us have a mother who has worked in the home and outside of the home to wear the dollar pin as a ribbon on Tuesday, and so that we can see a concerted effort to show that we have interest in this issue And in our small way, we're promoting the importance of the issue.
Right. We've just got a few minutes left. I'd just like to ask some motherly advice, if you will. What kind of advice would you put out here to the women that are listening today to call to action, if you will?
Well, I would encourage them to contact their local women's organizations, whether they be business and professional women, AAUW, League of Women Voters, any coalition. There are several faith-based women's organizations that are very involved in social justice, to call them and ask them what they know is happening locally.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very easy thing to do. Just call their neighbor and say, do you know what's going on in our town? Secondly, I would ask them to follow up on your wonderful lead to wear the ribbon, the dollar ribbon, and note that we're making 73 cents a dollar on that day and that week. We're encouraging people to start wearing them, you know, at the beginning of the week so that we can see that this is happening. It's not just a one-day event.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would also encourage them, and this is something I always encourage people who are advocates, no matter what their issue of passion is to contact their legislators, especially those that they know on a person-to-person basis, and say, do you know today is equal pay day, and this is an issue that is critical to me and my family, and I want you to consider, you know, what you have done to advance pay equity for women.
And let them know that you're mad about it.
Exactly. That you're committed. And let them know that doesn't necessarily have to be mad. It has to be just a passion,
mm-hmm.
To talk your story. I guess that's another thing, to share your story, how the fact that you're making less money impacts on you and your family and your children and our children's children, our future.
Get her to announce her contact info.
Okay. Once again, Chris, if you would give us your contact information.
All right. You can contact the Texas Pay Equity Committee in Austin, and the number there is 512-452-5109, or you can contact any business and professional women's organization in your town, definitely I have no problem someone contacting me, Chris Michalek. It's Michalek, and I'm going to give my email, which is michalek@mindspring.com.
Okay.
So if you want to know how to find out what's going on in your town, I encourage you to contact me, and I will quickly find your local person to help you celebrate this day on Tuesday.
And as well, we gave out the AFL-CIO local number. And
that's wonderful. Yes.
And I'm sure that they could, if they persist, that they could get some information out of them. And once again, Chris, thanks a bunch for coming on and talking with us about this, what I feel is a very important issue, and I hope you have great success, or we have great success this coming Tuesday.
Appreciate the invitation.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Well, we're about ready to wrap up what I'd hope was a educating and entertaining program for working people in Houston.
I think it was a good start. There's still a lot more issues that we'd like to bring up with these guests, but we'll have a chance to bring them on in the future and other guests.
Yeah, and hopefully that you'll keep the phone calls coming in and the questions and the comments. That's what we're trying to do here. Before we close, though, I've got a telephone number. You might want to write this down in a contact name. There's for the May Day activities that are planned. I believe May Day is Wednesday of next month, May 1st, International Workers' Day. And a contact number is 713-864-0972. And I believe the contact person is Scott Freer. Give him a call, and he'll bring you up to speed on what kind of activities that they have planned for May Day.
Yeah, so, we'd just like to say thank you to all our guests and everybody that called in, and look forward to speaking with you again. Well, we'll see when. We'll put the word out, but we'll be back soon.
Continue listening to the station, and remember, if you made a pledge, please send it in. That's how we keep it on the air.
Send the check.
Thanks again. This has been Voices at Work with Tim Pagel
and Ron Gagne.
Have a good one.
Take care.
not an arm. A weapon, solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood. The list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the worker.
War on the worker.
They boost your copay.
War on the workers.
Don't you know what to say?
War on the workers.
When they talk privatization.
War on the workers.
And cooperation.
War on the workers.
When they call you a team.
War on the workers.
You better learn how to scream.
War on the workers.
Oh, that's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on child labor protection. It's a war on the 8-hour day. It's a war on occupational health and safety. It's a war on Social Security. Now, thanks to WTO, GATT, NAFTA, MAI, the IMF, and the World Bank, it's a worldwide war. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Yeah, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time, sisters and brothers, you know it's time right now. I said it's time we started calling the shots.
I like this one.
We got this is Katie Turner from Justification, and you're listening yeah. to KPFT Houston.
All right, brother.
Oh, man.
Now we can go home, take those Valiums, and pass out.
Yeah, no joke.
The world's attention is riveted on Palestine, where Israel, supported by over $10 million daily from the United States, is waging a war of terror against the Palestinian people. As American citizens, we have a special role to play in calling for a halt to the horror. On Wednesday, April 17th, a Palestinian human rights advocate, Hanan El-Masu, will be in Houston to discuss the conflict in Palestine and explain why U.S. citizens may be the key to peace in the Middle East. Hanan El-Masu will speak at the University of Houston at 3 p.m. and at the Rice University Media Center at 7 p.m. That's on Wednesday, April 17th. And she'll also be on KPFT's Open Journal at noon that same day. For updates or more information, you can go to the web at houston.indymedia.org, I-N-D-Y-M-E-D-I-A, or email buzz@uh.edu, or call 713-743-3093.
Friend Black Peter. Thousands of children and adults cheer for Sinterklaas and Black Peter at the dock. Church bells in the city ring and the parade starts with a motorcade of police leading a big brass fuck you band. In the Netherlands, the gift giver is St. Nicholas, and he is known as Sinterklaas. He arrives by steamer in Amsterdam in early December wearing a bishop's robe, white gloves, and a large Episcopal ring on his left hand. He leaves the ship riding a white horse and is accompanied by his faithful friend, Black Peter. Thousands of children and adults cheer for Sinterklaas and Black Peter at the dock, church bells in the city ring, and a parade starts with a motorcade of police leading a big brass band. Sinterklaas and Black Peter follow the band, then comes the mayor, civic leaders, and decorated floats. The procession stops at the Royal Palace, where Sinterklaas is greeted by the Queen. This is where Sinterklaas establishes his headquarters. He delivers gifts to the nice children on December 6th, while his friend Black Peter... This is hard. In the Netherlands, the gift giver is St. Nicholas, and he is known as Sinterklaas. He arrives by steamer in Amsterdam in early December wearing a bishop's robe, white gloves, and a large Episcopal ring on his left hand. In the Netherlands, the gift giver is St. Nicholas, and he is known as Sinterklaas. He arrives by steamer in Amsterdam in early December wearing a bishop's robe, white gloves, and a large Episcopal ring on his left hand. He leaves the ship riding a white horse and is accompanied by his faithful friend, Black Peter. Thousands of children and adults cheer for Sinterklaas and Black Peter at the dock. Church bells in the city ring and a parade starts with a motorcade of police leading a big brass band. Sinterklaas and Black Peter follow the band, then comes the mayor, civic leaders, and decorated floats. The procession stops at the Royal Palace, where Sinterklaas is greeted by the Queen. This is where he establishes his headquarters. He delivers gifts to the nice children on December 6th, while his friend Black Peter spanks the naughty ones. Presents in Holland are exchanged on December 6th. The gifts are called surprises because it is traditional to disguise the gift you're giving as much as possible. Small gifts are placed inside huge boxes or hidden inside a vegetable or a pudding. Surprises should be accompanied by singing. On Christmas Day, no presents are given. There are church services on Christmas Eve, and it is traditional to have a holiday feast afterwards. The tree is the center of the celebration. December 26 is called Second Christmas Day, and people spend their time relaxing and visiting friends. Oh, stupid. KPFT celebrates the holidays in all its forms. In the Netherlands, the gift giver is St. Nicholas, and he is known as Sinterklaas. He arrives by steamer in Amsterdam in early December wearing a bishop's robe, white gloves, and a large Episcopal ring on his left hand. He leaves the ship riding a white horse and is accompanied by his faithful friend Black Peter. Thousands of children and adults cheer for Sinterklaas and Black Peter at the dock. Church bells in the city ring, and a parade starts with a motorcade. KPFT celebrates the holidays in all its forms. In the Netherlands, the gift giver is St. Nicholas, and he is known as Sinterklaas. He arrives by steamer in Amsterdam in early December wearing a bishop's robe, white gloves, and a large Episcopal ring on his left.